Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Okay, so today we're diving into Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. It's such a foundational piece of dystopian fiction, isn't it? But what always strikes me is how different its warning feels compared to, say, 1984.
Oh, absolutely. People often lump them together, but they're really poles apart. Orwell's big fear was control through pain, through oppression, right?
Yeah, the boot stamping on a human face forever.
Exactly. Huxley, though, he was warning about something almost creepier. Control through pleasure.
Yes.
Through giving us everything we think we want, making us love our servitude.
It's a really chilling thought. And Huxley himself, he came from this incredible family background, didn't he? Science and literature woven together.
Right. T.H. Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, was his grandfather.
Yeah.
So he had this deep understanding, maybe even anxiety, about where science could lead if it wasn't guided by, well, wisdom or ethics.
And writing in 1932, yeah. You can see the seeds of it all. Mass production, consumerism starting up, mass media.
He just took those trends and pushed them to their logical, terrifying conclusion. He saw Ford's assembly line not just for cars, but for human beings and society itself.
So the big question this novel forces us, and you the listener, to confront is this kind of engineered happiness, this painless, stable, but ultimately meaningless life, actually better than the messy, difficult, but maybe more real existence we associate with freedom?
That's the core tension, definitely. Happiness versus truth, comfort versus meaning, it runs through the entire story.
Okay, let's get into the mechanics of this world state. It's AF 632 after Ford 632. The motto is community, identity, stability. How do they actually achieve that stability? It sounds like it starts right at the beginning or even before.
It absolutely does. Yeah. In the Central London Hatchery and Conditioning Center, humans aren't born anymore. They're decanted, grown in bottles.
Decanted. Wow.
Yeah. And the process is pure industry. You've got the Bokanovsky process, which is, well, it's essentially industrial scale cloning for the lower castes. One fertilized egg is chemically shocked, so it's buds, producing up to 96 identical twins.
96. All destined for the same job, perfectly suited, no variation.
Maximum efficiency. And these individuals are sorted into five distinct castes. You have the alphas at the top, intelligent, manage things, all the way down to the epsilons.
And the epsilons are deliberately stunted, right? Less oxygen in the fetal stage.
Exactly. Engineered for the most menial tasks, incapable of discontent because they literally can't conceive of anything else. That's biological predestination.
But biology isn't enough, is it? They need to control the mind too.
Oh, completely. Conditioning is relentless from infancy.
Yeah.
Neo-Pavlovian methods think electric shocks paired with books or flowers for lower castes. So they develop a visceral hatred for them.
So they won't waste the state's time reading or wanting beauty.
Precisely. And then there's hyptopedia. Sleep teaching, moral slogans, social directives whispered into their ears for years while they sleep. It bypasses reason entirely.
We get those unforgettable slogans drummed into them, like everyone belongs to everyone else.
Yeah, which completely obliterates family, monogamy, any kind of intense personal relationships. Those are seen as unstable, dangerous.
And economically, ending is better than mending. Just keep consuming. Keep the wheels turning.
It's engineered consumerism. Throw things away. Buy new things. It fuels the economy and keeps people superficially satisfied. Constant novelty.
Okay, so you've got the biological control, the psychological conditioning. But what about the human need for something more? If you get rid of art, religion, philosophy, even challenging science because they're destabilizing, what fills that void? How do you keep people genuinely content day to day?
Well, largely through distraction and instant gratification. Promiscuity is encouraged. It's consequence-free. Entertainment is highly sensory, but shallow things like obstacle golf or the feelies, which are like movies, but you feel the physical sensations.
Touchy-feely movies, basically.
Pretty much. But the real linchpin, the ultimate safety valve, is Soma.
Ah, Soma. The perfect drug. What makes it so effective, so different?
It works perfectly. With no real hangover or downside, apparently.
Right.
It provides an immediate escape from any unpleasant emotion, boredom, sadness, doubt. A quick Soma holiday, they call it.
Eastman calls it Christianity without tears. All the comfort, None of the struggle or belief.
Exactly. It numbs any impulse toward rebellion or deep thought.
No.
Why struggle with difficult feelings when you can just pop a gram and feel blissful?
Hmm.
It's control through sedation, through induced happiness.
This engineered happiness, though, it creates these fault lines, these characters who just don't quite fit. Hmm. Let's start with Bernard Marx. He's an alpha plus, high caste, but he's different.
Yeah, Bernard's interesting because his unhappiness isn't really philosophical at first anyway. It's deeply personal. He's physically smaller than other alphas. There were these rumors about alcohol accidentally put in his blood surrogate when he was developing.
So if he's inadequate,
yeah,
resentful.
Totally.
Oh.
And a lot of his critique of the world state stems from that resentment, that feeling of being excluded. It makes his rebellion feel a bit hollow, you know? It's often about his own ego.
And you see that play out, don't you? When he brings John the Savage back and suddenly becomes famous, he completely buys into the system he claimed to despise.
He laps it up, the parties, the women. His principles evaporate pretty quickly once he gets social validation. He's not strong enough to truly stand outside it.
Okay, then there's Lenina Crown. If Bernard is the resentful outsider, Lenina is almost the perfect product of the system, right? A beta.
She really is. She's content, does her job efficiently. She works with vaccinations at the hatchery, enjoys the casual sex, the feelies, soma. She embodies the state's ideals pretty well.
But there are tiny cracks, aren't there? Like her dating one man, Henry Foster, for several months.
Yeah, that's considered quite unconventional, even a bit odd. It hints at maybe a flicker of something more, but it is deeply buried. Her real limitation shows up when she encounters John. She just cannot comprehend his intense emotions. His ideas about love, honor, sin, grief, they're completely outside her conditioned reality. She can process physical desire, but not deep emotional connection or turmoil. The language of the human heart, you could say, is just meaningless noise to her.
Before we get to John, who really drives the conflict, we have to talk about Mustafa Mond, the world controller. He's fascinating because he understands everything that was lost.
He's absolutely central, one of only 10 world controllers. He's not just enforcing the system, he's its intellectual architect and defender. He knows about Shakespeare, about God, about history.
He chose this path, didn't he? He was a scientist.
A brilliant physicist doing forbidden research. He was given a choice, exile or become a controller and help manage the stability he now oversees. He chose control. He argues, very persuasively within the novel's logic, that happiness and stability for the masses were worth sacrificing truth, art, and freedom. He's the voice of benevolent tyranny.
That sets up the core conflict perfectly. So the plot really kicks into gear when Bernard manages to persuade Lenina to go with him on a trip. Where do they go?
They go to the Savage Reservation in New Mexico. It's one of the few places left outside the world state's direct control where people still live.
Mm.
Well, naturally.
And what's that like for them? Must be a shock.
A huge shock. They see old age, disease, dirt, natural birth, families, religious rituals involving suffering,
yeah,
everything the world state has eliminated. Lenina is utterly horrified and disgusted. Bernard is more fascinated, but also sees an opportunity.
Because they find someone there.
They do. They find Linda, a beta, who got lost on a trip there years ago and was left behind. And crucially, she has a son, John.
And the father turns out to be
the director of hatcheries and conditioning, Bludar's boss.
Mm.
The man who was just threatening to exile Bernard for his nonconformity.
Ah, the irony. So Bernard sees his chance.
Absolutely. He gets permission to bring Linda and John back to London. It's his ticket to fame and a way to humiliate the director.
So John, the savage, arrives in London. He's the ultimate outsider, caught between two worlds. What shaped him back on the reservation?
Well, he grew up with the Zuni rituals, which are very different, obviously. But the most important influence was a book he found, an old copy of The Complete Works of William Shakespeare.
Shakespeare becomes his entire moral and emotional vocabulary.
Totally. Love, honor, jealousy, revenge, beauty, tragedy. He learns it all from Shakespeare. Concepts that just don't exist in the world state. So when he first sees London, he quotes Miranda from The Tempest. Oh, brave new world that has such people in it. He's hopeful, initially.
But that hope sours pretty fast.
Very fast. He's repulsed by the manufactured happiness, the lack of depth, the casual sex, the soma. It all seems obscene to him compared to the intense, meaningful, often painful world of Shakespeare's plays.
And this leads to that tragic misunderstanding with Lenina. He tries to court her based on his Shakespearean ideals.
Yes, he wants to prove himself worthy, to perform heroic deeds for her love, like in the plays. He puts her on a pedestal. But Lenina conditioned by everyone belongs to everyone else, just doesn't get it. She thinks he wants sex like everyone else, and when he rejects her advances violently, calling her an impudent strumpet, she's utterly bewildered and hurt.
There's just no common ground. He wants meaning. She wants pleasant sensations.
Exactly. The communication breakdown is total.
The real crisis point for John, though, comes with his mother, Linda. What happens to her back in London?
Linda can't cope with being back. She basically retreats into a permanent Soma holiday, consuming huge amounts until her body just shuts down. She dies in the Park Lane Hospital for the Dying.
And her death. It's treated just like another inconvenience, right?
Pretty much. The nurses are annoyed by John's loud grief because it's disrupting the death conditioning for the children visiting. Grief is an unknown, inappropriate emotion there. John is horrified by the casual, unfeeling atmosphere around his mother's deathbed.
This raw grief, something completely alien in this world, pushes him over the edge.
It does. He sees a group of Delta workers lining up for their Soma ration after work, and he just snaps. He tries to stop them, throws the Soma away, shouts at them about freedom and poison, tries to make them feel something real, even if it's bad.
Which obviously leads to chaos.
A full-blown riot.
Mm-hmm.
Helmholtz Watson, the alpha lecturer, who also feels constrained by the world state's shallowness, actually joins in to help John. Bernard sort of hovers nervously on the sidelines.
They all get arrested, which brings us to the intellectual heart of the novel, the confrontation between John and Mustafa Mond.
Yes, this is the big philosophical showdown. Mond brings John, Helmholtz, and Bernard to his office.
And Mond lays out his justification for this world he controls. What's his core argument?
It's a powerful utilitarian argument. He says stability is the highest good, that things like art, religion, intense emotions, even scientific truth beyond a certain point lead to instability, conflict, misery, the very things the old world suffered from.
So they traded deep meaning for universal, albeit shallow, happiness.
Exactly. He argues comfort is better than truth. Stability is better than the chaos that comes with passion and freedom. He makes a compelling case that most people wouldn't choose the difficult path if offered an easy, pleasant one.
But John refuses that bargain entirely. How does he respond?
He counters with that incredible declaration. He says, "But I don't want comfort. I want God. I want poetry. I want real danger. I want freedom. I want goodness. I want sin."
He claims the right to be unhappy.
Precisely. He demands the full spectrum of human experience, the highs and the lows, because that's what gives life meaning. Suffering, struggle, even sin, they're part of being truly human, not just a contented machine.
It really highlights the power of language, too, doesn't it? Helmholtz felt words should be like x-rays piercing through things. John's Shakespearean language is that x-ray, trying to pierce the conditioning.
Absolutely. Mond understands Shakespeare, but he's locked away because it's too potent, too truthful. John embodies that dangerous truth.
So what happens to the rebels after this debate? Mond deals with Bernard and Helmholtz quite pragmatically.
Yeah, he exiles them. Two islands where other nonconformists, people who are too individualistic for the world state, are sent. It's actually not a terrible punishment. They get to be among their own kind. Helmholtz is almost excited about finding a truly challenging audience.
But John refuses that kind of compromise. He wants something else.
He can't accept exile within the system. He wants total rejection, total purification. So he exiles himself to a remote, abandoned lighthouse outside London. He tries to live an ascetic life, growing his own food, praying, even whipping himself to purge the contamination of civilization.
A desperate attempt to reclaim some kind of purity or meaning through suffering.
Yes. But the world won't leave him alone. He gets discovered by reporters, and his self-flagellation becomes a sensation. It's filmed for the feelies.
Oh, no. He becomes a spectacle.
The ultimate perverse entertainment. Crowds start arriving in helicopters, chanting, "We want the whip." They treat his spiritual agony as just another thrill.
That's utterly devastating. How does it end for him?
In the final scene, the crowds provoke him into a frenzy. Soma is flowing. There's this orgy happening around the lighthouse. And John gets swept up in it. He succumbs to the very primal, unthinking hedonism he despises.
He participates in the orgy.
Yes. And the next morning, the reporters arrive to find him, hanging from the rafters of the lighthouse. His feet are described as dangling, slowly turning.
Just silence. A final, terrible indictment of a world that had no place for him.
Exactly. His suicide is the ultimate proof that this brave new world cannot accommodate a soul that craves meaning beyond comfort. There's no escape, no refuge.
It's such a powerful ending, and the novel's warning. It feels incredibly relevant today, doesn't it? Maybe even more than Orwell's in some ways. this idea of control through pleasure, distraction, consumerism, pharmacology.
It's disturbingly prescient. The constant stream of entertainment, the reliance on medication for mood management, the pressure to consume. Huxley saw where those trends could lead if unchecked.
It really forces you to ask constantly, what are we willing to sacrifice? What essential parts of being human are we willing to smooth away or engineer out just for the sake of comfort and convenience?
And maybe true freedom isn't about having no limits, but about having the right and the strength to choose the difficult, meaningful path despite the pain it might involve.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acacha Foundation.